Hi, I'm Bob Moon in for Tess Bigland, and this is the Marketplace Money Podcast for the week of September 9th, 2011. The terror attacks of 9/11/2001 changed our lives in so many ways, including our financial decisions.
It made me live for the moment a little bit more. I also started to realize that 9/11 did not do away with long-term planning. I still had to sort of get back on that horse and plan my future.
Listeners tell us how 9/11 made them stronger. A disaster's effect on our bank accounts is one thing. Beware, too, of scars deep within our psyches.
Imagine someone who put all their eggs in one basket, didn't have a backup plan, and really prided themselves in being able to sort of take care of the people they love, and it's suddenly gone.
We'll explore financial PTSD, plus expecting an inheritance? Oh, really?
We've given them their bequest while we're still alive, and we can enjoy seeing them benefit from it.
Maybe it's already been spent. Those stories and more ahead on Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon in for Tess Vigeland, and this is Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. If you think about it, and who hasn't this week, it's really not an exaggeration to say that 9/11 has changed the way we live. It certainly changed how millions of us travel, how businesses go about doing business. And it turns out it's changed a lot of us for the better. Many of our listeners wrote in to tell us how September 11th affected things like their relationship with work, with money, and the financial choices they've made since.
My name is Joyce Ng, and on September 11th, I was at the Marriott Hotel, which was part of the World Trade Center complex. When you're so close to death, you think about what will happen if you're gone. Of course, my husband now and I thought about that. And since having a child now, we did set up life insurance and also having a will in case anything does happen, that she's well prepared and financially prepared. I'm the child of immigrant parents, and my grandparents always saved every penny. I'm a good saver, but after September 11th, I spent more money, I think, than I did before, because I wanted to enjoy doing things that I loved. I was a consultant before, and I traveled frequently on business. So right now, I'm no longer in consulting. I still work in business, where I don't have to be away from my family.
My name is Troy Rutman, and I live in Phoenix, Arizona. On 9/11, I was in New York City on my way to work. I was working as a head of business development for an online marketing agency. And when the actual first impact happened, I was on the train. But when I walked into the lobby of my office building, I saw the fire that had already started burning. And I think it was such a shock to everyone's system that as the days and weeks started to mount, and the shockwaves it sent through the economy, it became clear that everyone started to feel like, whoa, what does this mean for my future? My immediate reaction was, I need to get out of here. I mean, it just was very dark. I'd lost a childhood friend who had worked for Cantor Fitzgerald, and it really changed my relationship to New York. My partner and I moved down to Puerto Rico for about 6 months after that, and we tried our hand at opening a bed and breakfast in a very rural part of the island. It was an escape. I mean, I just woke up and fed the chickens and went to try to build a business from scratch that could give me a livelihood in which I wasn't dependent upon anyone else. And although I would like to think that it made me live for the moment a little bit more, I also started to realize that 9/11 did not do away with long-term planning. I still had to save. I still had to figure out my career track, and I still had to sort of get back on that horse and plan my future.
My name is Kristen Kretschmer. My husband was working at American Eagle when 9/11 happened. He was the first pilot to leave Logan after 9/11. American Eagle, in the months that followed, they began furloughing their pilots. And my husband was downgraded back to first officer, which essentially cut his pay in half. We have just started to be able to get back to the path that we thought was going to happen back in 2001.
My name's Kevin Jarrett. And on September 11th, I was on the 13th floor of the Aramark Tower in Philadelphia, working with my colleagues. I mean, I was making $100,000 a year, and I had always dreamed of being a teacher. I had wanted to be a teacher when I graduated or when I was in undergrad. And my dad told me that wouldn't work because I'd never be able to feed my family. So like a good son, I went off and got my degree in business, ultimately got my MBA. We were living on half of my salary. And I did the math, and it finally occurred to me that, wait a minute, if we're living on $50,000 a year and a teaching job pays $35,000, that's only a $15,000 delta to make it work. And that night I got home and said, look, honey, you know, I want to do this. And she looked at me and said, okay. 9/11 for me was the catalyst for a period of introspection over months. You know, why do something that is not what you absolutely love to do? And today I'm blessed. I'm surrounded by the two things I love most in life, and that's kids and technology. I couldn't be happier.
The voices of Joyce Eng, Troy Ruttman, Kristen Kretschmer, and Kevin Jarrett. You can hear more post 9/11 reflections on our website, marketplace.org.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
As we just heard, the terrorist attacks on September 11th prompted many people to make big changes in their lives and with their finances. Business psychiatrist Dr. Mark Goulston says 9/11, along with more recent financial disasters like the 2008 subprime mortgage crisis and financial collapse, have deeply scarred our national psyche.
Many of us are going through the equivalent of post-traumatic stress disorder. That name has been thrown around in many places, often attached to returning veterans. A thumbnail of what that is often when you're traumatized and you're traumatized severely, and for people whose money or life savings has really taken huge hits, that's a trauma. What happens is you do whatever you can to sort of make it through it, but you don't get over it. You get past it. And it kind of breaks through your feeling that nothing can hurt me.
So I would guess that there's a bigger chance that you would be more affected by something like, say, the big financial meltdown than 9/11 in many ways, because it directly would affect your finances.
I think what goes on for a lot of people is something that I call the four Ds of financial PTSD, and that's debt, dependency, distrust, and then our denial isn't working. And what that means is when you're in debt, whenever someone calls you to try and get money from you, it re-traumatizes you. It makes you realize how you don't have what you thought you had. And then when you feel that vulnerable, you reach out. Who can I depend on? Who can I rely on? I'll call my stockbroker. I'll call my financial person. I'll read the news. And then what happens is when you hear the news changing from day to day, you feel, I can't trust anyone. So when you're in a state of feeling like the world is trying to take more money from you and you don't even have that much left over, and who can you depend on because you don't know what you can do under your own control, and the people that you have trusted, you can't trust anymore, it puts you into this real state of irritability, almost brittleness, fragility. And that's where the fourth D is. What allows us to get through life is denial that functions.
I'd rather not think about it.
There you go. I mean, if we were aware of how dangerous it is to drive, how dangerous it is to fly, all the side effects of every medication we take, if we didn't have healthy denial, we would be frozen. So I think what's happening is that people are living with these four Ds constantly, which leads to, so what do you do about it? So anything that will help you regain a sense of control will help you feel better. And also talk with each other and you listen to each other, it makes it better.
Now, the skeptic in me, though, wants to say, look, this is financial trauma. Is this really PTSD?
At its extreme, it is. Some of my closest friends ran the Marines for a number of years. And what they've shared with me is every Marine who has been in a war has PTSD. It's just a matter of degree. Mm-hmm. Anyone who has seen horrors can't help but be haunted by them. But there's a whole continuum about where it breaks into your daily functioning and your ability to interact with other people. So let me hit the skeptic in you. Imagine someone who put all their eggs in one basket, didn't have a backup plan, and really prided themselves in being able to sort of take care of the people they love, and it's suddenly gone with no hope of getting it back. I mean, I can see that there's a skeptical look in you, but in your mind's eye, can't you imagine that someone like that would qualify for PTSD?
What are some of the warning signs, if you will, that you might be experiencing this?
Okay, warning signs are you feel a change in your personality, you tend to be irritable, you snap at people, you're withdrawn. But the key signs for PTSD is that you tend to relive the event over again, either in dreams or you even have flashbacks when you read the newspaper. And you want to avoid it. You want to avoid being re-traumatized because if you're feeling vulnerable and you get another hit, a lot of people feel, I'll shatter. I just won't come back. And then the third thing is that you have this increased arousal and you're hypervigilant. So you can't ever totally lower your guard. And if you think about it, think about that you can never lower your guard so you never know what it's like to relax.
For someone who's listening to this and thinking, that describes my loved one or my coworker, what could they do to help someone out?
You don't need one of your loved ones' permission to intervene in their life to protect them and help them and prevent them from going in deeper. Instead of asking permission, instead of saying, are you all right, when you've seen all these symptoms, I think what you say to them is you could say, you know, you may not like me after this, but as your friend, as your loved one, I don't need your permission, and I've found a place, and I am taking you there, and we are going there. And you can yell at me the whole way there, but I would expect the same from you. And I think if you can come from a sense of strength and confidence and firmness and protectiveness, I think they may not smile at you, but inside they will feel relieved. And one day they will be grateful to you. Some of them will be grateful that you saved their lives.
And last question, why shouldn't I feel debilitated by all of this, particularly if I'm close to retirement and my whole life has just been wiped out?
Well, a lot of that comes back to your perspective on life, what is really important to you. And I think if you can find something that enables you to get past venting or beating up on yourself to actually exhaling, that can tend to recenter you and relieve you. And one of the best ways to do that is to care about others and feel cared about by them.
Dr. Mark Goulston's latest book is Just Listen, Discover the Secret to Getting Through to Absolutely Anyone. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
And if you want to hear more about dealing with financial PTSD, I recommend checking out our Making Money blog at marketplace.org. The job market is so tough here in the U.S. Is it time to start looking beyond the border?
We tried several times. We couldn't get a job. So we started exploring different cities that would work for us and ended up in Calgary, honestly.
That story is coming up on Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. And it's time to take your money questions. Here to help is MSN personal finance columnist and money know-it-all, Liz Pulliam-Weston.
Hi, Bob.
Hey, Liz. I've got to ask you before we go to the callers about this story I read about a new kind of plastic, something called the Duo Card. Fifth Third Bank, based out of Cincinnati, is offering this now. Other banks apparently testing similar cards. This is a piece of plastic that you can use as both a debit and credit card. How does this work?
Well, most of your debit cards, you know, if you give a debit card, they'll ask you, do you want to do debit or credit? So you can actually have it processed by one of two systems. One means you type in your PIN code.
So what's different about this one?
Well, this one, when you sign your name and signature like a credit card, it's actually treated as a credit card transaction. In other words, you can pay it off over time if you want. It doesn't immediately come out of your checking account. So that's what's different about this card.
So the story I read suggested that customers have been wanting these two-in-one cards. is this really what we've been waiting for, or is it just another way to get ourselves into trouble? Downsides?
Well, you know, you want to have fewer things. I mean, we used to have cameras and camcorders and music players and phones, and now we just have our phones. So consolidating seems like a good idea. I just think you'd have to be pretty mentally flexible to keep track of what you're using and how you're using it, because if you make a mistake and say, yeah, I want to process that as a debit transaction, and you don't have enough money in your account, you've got a bounce fee to pay. So,
But theoretically, it should not. It should kick it back, right?
Well, that's a good question. Will you be required to sign up for overdraft protection if you have this?
Uh-huh.
And my reading of it was that you would. So it's something to think about, because now, you know, we have the system where you don't have to have overdraft protection automatically. You can have point-of-sale transactions declined if you don't have enough money in your checking account. It's an open question whether this would be structured that way.
Which leads me to my next question. There's got to be something in it for the banks.
They want as big a share of your wallet and your spending as possible. You know, they've been fighting each other for business, and their ability to expand in the United States is kind of being constrained. Just about everybody who wants a credit card can get a credit card of some kind. And so they're trying to figure out ways to get you to use their plastic for more transactions. And the idea is, well, if you use one bank's card for everything you can think of, you know, they make more money from that.
And if you use your credit card more, you're more likely to have to pay those interest fees, right?
Well, that's the thing. You want to be very careful with this, because it could easily lead to a situation where you're piling up credit card debt and not remembering it.
All right, let's head to the phones. Scott is calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hello, Scott.
Hello.
So I hear you have an issue with something most people would consider a financial basic, an emergency fund?
Yeah, you know, it goes back to the cash versus credit that you're talking about. And over the past, I don't know, as many episodes as I can remember on a Marketplace Money, every time someone mentions this cash emergency fund, and it's almost like this basic that everyone should have. And, you know, I cringe every time I hear that, because one, I don't have one, and two, I don't know if it makes sense for everyone to have that.
Well, aren't you optimistic?
I mean, I've got a plan. I just want to make sure that my plan makes sense and there aren't any big holes.
Okay, run it past us.
Okay, so what I do is I take any of my excess dollars and I throw them into, you know, a Roth, into a 401k, and then the kids' education fund. I'm trying to throw all of these dollars into these tax-advantaged vehicle. So what I have instead, or in lieu of this cash account, is that I'm lucky enough to be able to take out a home equity line of credit, some credit on my home. And what I haven't done, though, is I haven't tapped any of it. You know, I've got $20,000-$30,000 just sitting there, ready to be tapped if I need to, but there isn't a fee that the bank charges me to hold that credit. And so what I'm hoping is I'll never have that true emergency, that loss of a job or anything that's going to make me dip into that credit. And if that's the case, then I'm going to just do really well on all the tax advantage funds that I'm going for. That's kind of my, in lieu of cash, approach to that emergency fund. Does that make any sense?
Okay. So aside from depending on a home equity line of credit, which based on recent history doesn't sound too good to me, what about it, Liz? This does sound logical. In a sense, he's sort of got a complicated savings plan, doesn't he?
Well, here's the thing. Emergency funds are overrated. Scott's absolutely right about that. We tell people you got to have this. It's got to be 3 months worth of expenses. At least 6 months is better. A year is even better. Here's the thing. The average family could take as many as 2 years, maybe even longer, just to pile up 3 months expenses. Definitely an emergency fund is not going to be a top priority for most families. Here are my concerns, though.
Okay. The other shoe drops here.
Well,
in lieu of building, you know, while you're building up an emergency fund, using, you know, having some credit is a good idea, because things happen along the way. And before you build up your fund, you may well have a need for money. And a home equity line of credit that's open and unused is a pretty good way to go, because the interest rates are low.
Provided that equity line doesn't go away.
There's the thing.
Okay, that's I thought that might be an issue. And I'm hoping that, let's say I lose my job, the bank won't find out. Isn't that the case?
No. It's not. That's not necessarily what would cause them to freeze it. What would cause them to freeze it is, you know, home prices going down farther, mm-hmm. or they change their policy and decide you don't have enough equity anymore. I mean, the home equity line is available at their whim. If you have a ton of equity, that might not be something that you necessarily need to worry about. Now let's talk about the Roth. I love Roths, and I don't think they should be tapped for any reason. Mm. Yes, it's easy to get that money out, but here's the thing. Every $10,000 you take out is going to cost you $200,000 or more down the line in terms of lost tax-free retirement income.
Ouch.
Roths are so valuable, you just don't want to dig into them if you don't have to. So, and with the kids, he's right. College is going to cost, so you don't want to be tapping into that 529. You can take that money back. There's a penalty. You know, you have to pay 10% on any earnings. You kind of want to leave that alone. So I'm not saying that everybody has to have an emergency fund right now and to make it the top priority. But Scott, I really would make it a priority along the line to have some cash. I think you have a lot of the right ideas, but nothing beats cash in the bank. And I know it's hard because your other saving venues are working really hard for you. You're getting tax deductions, you know, you're getting returns.
Right.
And putting money in a bank account, it's just sitting there in a rocking chair. But that's exactly what you want in an emergency. God forbid something should happen with your kids that isn't covered by insurance. You need a pile of cash to pay for care. Feels so good to make sure that the money is there.
All right. Sounds real good.
Scott, we've given you some things to think about, huh?
You have.
Thanks, Scott.
Great. Thank you.
Let's go to John from Billings, Montana. Hello, John.
Hi. How are you?
Good. Thank you. So what's your problem?
My wife and I, we also had a HELOC loan, and we applied for an increase because we wanted to put some windows in our home. And this was through Bank of America.
Mm-hmm.
And through the mail, we received our individual credit scores, and they came through Experian. And mine was lower than I thought it should be, so I went online to Experian's website, paid a dollar, got my personal score, only to find it was 59 points higher than was reported on our report through Bank of America. Now, the reports were dated only 9 days apart, and I thought, well, jeepers, which one did they use? Can things change that quickly? And which one's valid? We ultimately canceled the increase on it because of, you know, it was a higher rate. But that change of 59 points in 9 days had me a little concerned. What can you tell me about that?
Hmm. You're our resident credit expert, Liz. So what about this?
Okay, here's the thing. It's pretty simple. Experian sells FICO scores to mortgage lenders. Experian sells plus scores to consumers.
Oh, geez.
It's a whole different score. The fact that it's 60 points, that yours is 60 points higher, is about in line with what I've heard from other people, that when they're buying these scores directly from the credit bureaus, they think they're getting the same score that lenders use. Typically, they're not. What they're getting is some sort of consumer education score, and it can be 30 to 100 points higher than your actual FICO score that lenders are using.
So what's a consumer to do here?
Well, and here's the other problem, is Experian won't sell you your FICO score, period. You can get your FICO score for Equifax and TransUnion, the other two bureaus, from myfico.com. Now, if you go directly to the bureau, again, you're going to get something else. But if you go to MyFICO, you can actually get a FICO score from those two bureaus. Experian won't even sell you your FICO score through that venue. So there is no way you can see your FICO score as a consumer unless a lender shows it to you.
So what good are these other scores that they're selling me then?
Well, here's the question. I mean, if you're paying for it, my idea is if you're paying for it, you might as well make sure that you're buying the same score that lenders are saying, mm-hmm. and that's a FICO. And if it doesn't say it's a FICO, it's not a FICO. I hear from people all the time, oh, I got a free score from here. Or I got, you know, I paid $6.95 for a score over here. Those are not the scores that lenders are using. It has to say FICO. And the other thing we have to keep in mind is that the FICO score itself is often tweaked for different industries. So you might have, you know, a FICO score for auto lending and one for credit cards and a different one for mortgage. And, you know, they're going to be a little bit different. But if you get the FICO score through MyFICO, at least it's going to be closer to what the lenders are looking at than anything you buy anywhere else.
Is there anything you can do to keep from being blindsided by that FICO score?
I would go to myfico.com and get the two available FICO scores.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it would be much more helpful if you could see all three, especially with mortgage lending decisions, because they tend to use the middle score. Without seeing all three, you can't know what the middle score is. But at least you'll have some idea of the ballpark. And right on MyFICO, they have a you know, a graphic that will show you what interest rates you should be getting for various types of loans based on your score. At least you'll have that knowledge going in. And if it's a case like this with the home equity line of credit, you might be able to shop around a little bit. But again, it's going to be heavily influenced by your actual FICO scores. So I might put some effort into boosting that FICO score before I go back and apply again. And my feeling is you could probably get your score up fairly quickly, you know, over a few months if you do things like pay down your credit cards, make sure you're not using more than 10% of your available credit. Don't apply for any new cards, you know, in the coming months. Review your credit reports, make sure there are no mistakes, and you probably can pop that score up a bit and maybe get a better interest rate.
Thanks, John. We answered your question. I'm pretty sure you're not happy with it, but because I'm not. But thank you for calling.
Thanks, Bob. Thanks, Liz.
You bet, John.
Let's go to Alan from San Francisco. Hello, Alan.
Hi. How are you?
Good. Welcome to the show. What's your question?
Well, I think I'm in a somewhat unusual situation. My 80-year-old father has recently asked me for about $14,000 to save his house from auction. He's a serial entrepreneur who has never really struck it big, and he's just in a position now where he's 4 months behind on his mortgage and has no savings, has very bad credit because he's lived his life this way his whole last 40 years as an entrepreneur. And I have told him once already that I don't really think that it's a good idea for me to give him this money. He's in this situation as a result of some long-term choices that he's made. He's very passionate about his work, and he really believes that it's going to hit big very soon. But he's been saying that for the last 40 years.
Mm-hmm. Another optimist here.
Yeah, I was going to say, this seems to be the show for optimism.
Uh-huh. Now, is this normal? Has he come to you for money before?
He came to me about a year ago, and over the course of the last year, I've given him probably about $5,000. Up to that time, he hadn't asked me for money for probably 20 years. He did ask me about 20 years ago for a short-term loan, which he paid back.
Liz, lending money to a parent is always rife with a lot of issues. How can you turn down your parent? You know? But is this a good thing for Alan to do?
Well, and that's a good question. Alan said this was an unusual situation, and unfortunately, Alan, it's not. I hear about these situations all the time. You know, we think about parents bailing out their kids. I hear from a lot of kids that are over and over bailing out their parents or worried that they're going to have to at some point because their parents are so profligate with their money. And my feeling is, well, let me ask you, Alan, can your dad afford this house? Why is he 4 months behind?
Well, I think that's really the nub of the question. I think it's too much house for him. He's married, but it's a bigger house than he and his wife need. I think that probably in the long run, given their financial situation, they need to be in a smaller house, and it's going to be humbling, I think, if he loses his house this way. So, you know, what I think I would be willing to do is to try to work with a landlord to maybe become the leaser of record and, you know, try to help him with a monthly rental payment that's significantly less than the $3,000 mortgage that he's got.
I think you put your finger on it, Alan, is if you gave him this money, it's probably just going to go down a black hole. And he'll probably lose the house anyway if they can't afford it. I mean, that's why they've fallen behind.
Alan, you're how old and he's how old?
I'm 50 and he's just about to turn 80.
So given these ages, Liz, this sounds like a really bad idea.
Oh, yeah, because, you know, Alan, you're going to be retiring in not too many years. You know, you need to be taking care and shepherding your money for your future and also for the reality that you're probably going to be supporting your dad for at least some period of his life. But I think what you've identified is probably the right way to go. I mean, as children, we have a responsibility to our parents. We have to make sure that they are in safe but affordable housing, something that they can stay in going forward. And that doesn't necessarily mean they have to stay in the house they're in now, you know, if that's not something that they and you can afford. And I don't think continuing to subsidize him at the rate of $3,000 a month or whatever it would take to keep him in this house makes any sense at all. So I think working with him to find some other place and perhaps being the co-signer. Does his wife work? Is there any money coming in on her side?
She does not. She's not much younger than he is. So she has some Social Security income, basically.
Yeah.
Let me have you put your Dr. Liz hat on here. How do you tell your father no?
What you do is you say, I love you, but I really can't give you this money. You know, I really don't think it will solve the problem right now. And I think we need to put our heads together for a long-term solution. And he's going to get mad, almost certainly, you know, because you're not doing what he wants you to do. He sees you as having available resources, give it to me kind of a thing. But you have to stand your ground. It's like, no, this is not the right choice.
Alan, it sounds like you're prepared to do that.
I am prepared. I have said no. And hearing you helps me in my resolve because I'm sure that I'm going to get another call. I think you're right. Being able to talk about a long-term solution is really the thing that has to happen.
Alan, good luck.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your help.
That's all the time we have for your questions, but if you have one of your own, let us know about it. The number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, M-O-N-Y. Or shoot us a note. Go to our website, marketplace.org, and type in Getting Personal in the search box. Liz Weston, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Bob.
And remember, always talk to your own money professional before you make any big financial decisions.
Show Marketplace Money how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/marketplacemoney.
Hands in my pocket, hands in my pocket, hands in my pocket.
Because of your giant wallet, just get rid of it. Never. It is a part of me.
My name is Peter Carvenin. I'm the owner of Faith Skateboard Shop in downtown Birmingham. My wallet's in my back pocket. What's in my wallet? This is my key card to the hostel that we stayed at in Ireland. The program that brought us over to Ireland was the A-Skate Foundation. We do skateboard clinics for children with autism. I have driver's license, 3 credit cards that are almost maxed out. And let's see. I have my very first dollar that my business ever made in 1995, deep in here somewhere. Very first dollar I ever made, but I can't find it. It's kind of like a good luck charm, you know? Like the very first dollar my shop ever made, and 16 years later, here I am, still doing it, and shoot, one day there probably won't even be dollar bills around, but hopefully my shop will be around.
If you're looking for an icebreaker in Alaska, I'll ask you to try the yard sales. They say the deals can't be beat.
They're all wonderful Alaskan seines made out of Alaskan wood, and they all were picked up for a fraction of the price at a garage sale.
That's ahead on Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon in for Tess Vigeland. When President Obama unveiled his $447 billion jobs package of stimulus spending and tax cuts this week, much of his focus was on making American workers competitive with the rest of the world.
We now live in a world where technology has made it possible for companies to take their business anywhere. If we want them to start here and stay here and hire here, we have to be able to outbuild and out-educate and out-innovate every other country on earth.
If we're buying Kias and Hyundais, Mr. Obama said, we need to be selling Fords and Chevys and Chryslers to the rest of the world.
I want to see more products sold around the world stamped with the 3 proud words, Made in America. That's what we need to get done.
Of course, one of our biggest exports in recent years has been jobs. And now it seems more American workers are even exporting themselves. As Marketplace's Adrienne Hill reports, that's not as easy as it may sound.
Consider this story a flowchart quiz kind of thing to see if you should look for your next job abroad. Ready? Let's begin. Please pull out a sheet of paper and a pencil. The first question, what field do you work in? Take a moment to write your answer down. Got it? If you wrote
energy, healthcare, pharmaceuticals, engineering, infrastructure, telecommunications, education, academia.
You're in luck. Stacey Burden is the author of the forthcoming book, Go Global, Launching an International Career Here or Abroad.
There's tremendous opportunity in some of these other markets for high growth that need well-educated people with experience to actually live and work, you know, to grow another economy in another, another part of the world.
Which leads us to question 2. Where do you want to move? Now, be careful with this one.
Many countries
particularly countries that Americans would tend to gravitate towards. Unemployment is high there as well.
Melanie Holmes is a VP at Manpower International. She says in many parts of Europe, the unemployment situation is as bad or worse than it is here.
Americans might be jumping out of a frying pan and into a fire by trying to find work overseas.
But if you wrote down China, India, Brazil, Singapore, the United Arab Emirates, huzzah, you could be well on your way to becoming an employed expat. Countries with fast-growing economies are anxious for smart Americans. Now, question three, are you patient?
It's several months of work.
Gregory Hubbs is the editor-in-chief of transitionsabroad.com. He says getting an international job and getting all that paperwork figured out,
it's not something that generally can be done in a couple of weeks, no.
You need to find a country and a company that need your skill sets and jump the bureaucratic hurdles.
A vast number of countries require extensive work permits and visa documentation, which can prove challenging and time-consuming. So you have to be patient but determined.
One expat I talked to in Brazil said it took a year to get a visa. But this quiz isn't meant to scare anyone out of looking for a job abroad. It's plenty doable.
I'm Melinda Finley, and I am an ultrasound technician.
Okay, and I'm Steve Finley. I'm a business analyst.
Melinda and Steve used to live in northeastern Vermont. They left because Steve couldn't find work.
We tried several times. He couldn't get a job. So we started exploring different cities that would work for us. And ended up in Calgary, honestly.
And yes, Canada counts as abroad. They say the move is paid off. Melinda likes her job. She gets good career training, works on new equipment. Steve's got good, steady work, too.
We probably won't come back, we don't think. At least that's not in our current plan right now. We might move somewhere slightly warmer in Canada, because Calgary's a bit freezing in the winter. But we don't really think we'll ever come back to the States. We don't really have a good reason to, really.
And their advice for those considering the career jump abroad? Do the research. Hire experts to help you stay on the right side of the law and embrace your new home. Write that down. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace Money.
Have you noticed more and more adults are skiing these days? Let me explain, because somebody came up with that term, a shorthand for a new phenomenon. The SKIing in this case would be short for spending the kids' inheritance. A recent survey by the investment firm U.S. Trust found that fewer adults are bequeathing money to their children. Boston University finance professor Zvi Bode is with us to talk about this. Welcome.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here, Bob.
Doesn't it sort of stand things on its head that this is a generation that has been one of the richest, really, and is not leaving much behind?
Well, I don't quite agree with that. You know, I have two daughters. My wife and I have two daughters. We put them through college. We paid for graduate education. I think, in a way, we've given them their bequest, if you want to call it that, while we're still alive, and we can enjoy seeing them benefit from it.
So, in other words, instead of getting an inheritance, you're sort of getting a cash advance.
That's a good way of putting it, yeah.
And is that going to be the trend for future generations, do you think?
Let's bear in mind that the current norms for bequests in, let's say, the developed countries of the world is rather recent in terms of human history and even prehistory. You know, the traditional family was one where you had children, you took care of them when they were young, they took care of you when you got old. That was the way it worked.
So parents aren't maybe consciously denying their inheritance, but boomers are staying active longer than their forebears. They're taking care of parents whose lives have been extended by medical science, and they're just spending away more.
Yeah, exactly. They're stretched to the limit. And my personal view, I mean, call me a cockeyed optimist, I see the kind of the silver lining here in that I think there are going to be a lot of job opportunities, career opportunities for boomers to stay in the workforce on at least a part-time basis. And to me, personally, I'm 68. I'm still working full-time. But I love my work, and you know, I have no intention of retiring. I think there are a lot of people like me out there.
I have to confess that I've never once anticipated an inheritance. You know, I've even told my parents, spend it. You know, that's yours.
Yeah, I did the same thing. I think a lot of bequests are essentially just by accident.
It might make good sense to talk about it early on, but it's still awkward. How do you do that? How do you approach it from the parent's standpoint or the child's standpoint?
Well, I agree. It is uncomfortable, and that's why I think the best way to bring it up is in the context of just knowing where the information is. Where do you keep the records? And making sure that whenever the inevitable final date arrives, the people who are left behind are able to locate all the assets.
And if you don't feel comfortable bringing it up, at least leave a good paper trail, huh?
Exactly right.
Zvi Bodhi is a professor of finance and economics at Boston University. Thank you very much for your insights.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
Just as job seekers find they need ever more and better qualifications to get hired, the lousy economy is causing colleges to keep raising their prices or lowering their quality, or in too many cases, doing both. It seemed to be a vicious, unsustainable cycle. Until now, commentator Kim Clark has this example of something done right.
Back in the 1950s, Nobel Prize-winning economist Milton Friedman warned that having colleges charge upfront tuition was a problem. It meant that smart but poor students might not be able to afford the education they need to maximize their talents. He thought it would be smarter to just collect a surcharge on their earnings after they graduated. Australia has tried this. It created a graduate surtax in the 1980s, and it's seen its college graduation rate skyrocket since then. An expensive private college in upstate New York is trying an even more promising version of educational investments. Clarkson University is offering a select group of young entrepreneurs free tuition in return for a 10% share of their startups. Clarkson already has one undergraduate and one graduate student studying under these terms, and it's recruiting up to 5 more teen entrepreneurs for the fall of 2012. Clarkson officials say that if these educational investments work out, they will pursue more. Imagine if all colleges' revenues depended upon their graduates' success. The invisible hand of the market would quickly crush diploma mills and party schools. Colleges would realize they couldn't afford to be soft on do-nothing professors or cheating students. Sure, there are lots of objections. If colleges had to wait for graduates' big earnings, would they even want to enroll liberal arts majors, for example? Well, there's evidence that liberal arts majors end up doing very well in the job market over the long term. So yes, this new way to fund college is risky. But what we're doing now is not working very well. We need to align the financial interests of colleges with those of their students. That would free the market to do what it does best, drive prices down and quality up.
Kim Clark is a senior writer for Money Magazine. When you think of Alaska, what comes to mind? Grizzly bears, maybe? The state's big oil pipeline? Or perhaps Sarah Palin. Many residents of the last frontier know Alaska's short summer season as a big time for yard sales. As Alaska Public Radio's Annie Feit explains, that's because deals in Alaska are hard to beat.
Your refrigerator, which is stainless steel, is an Amana. A refrigerator might not seem like your typical yard sale find, but Chuck and Cindy Graham are not your typical yard sale shoppers. They live in Wasilla, 40 miles from Anchorage, and almost everything in their house came from a yard sale. They take me on a tour.
This has come from the inside passage. It's a light that they replace lighthouses.
They point out couches, quilts, paintings. They even have a taxidermy grizzly bear. Chuck is especially fond of several pieces of engraved log furniture.
They're all wonderful Alaskan seines made out of Alaskan wood. And they all were picked up for a fraction of the price at a garage sale.
The Grahams estimate they've saved thousands of dollars over the years buying stuff secondhand, but they didn't become dedicated yard sale shoppers until they retired and moved to Alaska 7 years ago. They say the sales in their home state of North Carolina weren't nearly as good. Cindy says things are different in Alaska because there's a constant flow of people moving to and from the state.
And they don't want to take everything with them. And it's like the last minute, and they got to leave, and they got to get rid of this stuff. So you can really get good deals from people up here.
Alaska has one of the highest migration rates in the country. About 14% of the population turns over each year. On the way home from Chuck and Cindy's, I see a sign for a moving sale on the side of the road and can't resist, even though it's hard to find a spot to park. The place is packed with buyers. The seller, Brian Hansen, says it's no mystery why.
Knowing that somebody's trying to get rid of at least 90% of their stuff, you know, trying to get rid of it for cheap, you know.
So what did you just sell there?
A bike, yeah. Sold a bike for cheap. Probably about $100 less than what we bought it for. But, you know.
Brian and his wife are moving to France, farther than most. But even for families moving back to the lower 48, or outside in Alaska slang, packing a U-Haul full of belongings is not very practical. The drive to the nearest state, Washington, takes a minimum of 3 days. It's a fact that's helped fill the shelves of secondhand stores, like Lazy Dog Antiques in Anchorage. Kathy Dunham is the owner.
A lot of times they don't want to haul it outside. You know, it's expensive to ship something outside. And so they'll approach us. A lot of times it just comes right in the front door.
But for Chuck and Cindy Graham, there's nothing like the thrill of the hunt. To study their technique, I joined them for a round of yard sailing on a recent sunny morning. The first 3 sales we find are a bust, but then we pull up to a driveway of a fancy house near the mountains in Anchorage.
Ooh, I think I'm going to like this one. This is going to be a good one.
The Grahams peruse long tables that stretch out of the garage and into the driveway. They don't see much until Cindy spies a 5-foot-tall replica lighthouse perched on a stairway landing above the driveway. It's not for sale today, but that doesn't deter the Grahams. Cindy inquires about the lighthouse, and before we know it, she has a deal.
I'm getting that big one. $50. I want it.
Well, I guess I have to let her have it.
It's beautiful. I've been wanting one for my yard. It is gorgeous.
Cindy doesn't even try to negotiate. $50 seems like too good a deal, and she doesn't want to push her luck. The homeowner is clearly sad to see the lighthouse go, but she's moving and can't take it with her. And Chuck and Cindy Graham are more than happy to find room for it at their house. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit for Marketplace Money.
I hope you'll indulge a brief parting thought as we bring the program to a close on this most somber weekend. I will be so glad when we get past all these 9/11 retrospectives. Those aren't my words. I'm quoting a friend who was complaining to me this week about the flood of media coverage that was, of course, inevitable 10 years on from the attacks on the World Trade Center and Pentagon. But allow me to make the case for how important it is that we do remember. Certainly the lives lost and the sacrifices made. And something else. I fear our post-9/11 outlook on life has faded all too soon. If you walked into any store or office building or just down the streets of New York City in the dark days and months after 9/11, you couldn't help but feel a common bond, a strong sense of happy to see you, glad you're here, community. And it seemed everyone had suddenly shifted their priorities. The other day, I came across an interview I did in the aftermath of 9/11 with a Wall Street stockbroker friend, Ted Weisberg,
confiding what that harrowing day had taught him, that there are so many things more important than money.
I think September 11th really made you kind of refocus what your priorities are in terms of how important the business is compared to the other things going on in my life or around me. Perhaps coming to Wall Street is not quite as important as it used to be.
When it comes to keeping an eye on that bigger picture beyond the dollars and cents, I don't think I can put it any better. Thanks so much for making us a part of your weekend. We're glad you're here. And that's Marketplace Money. Friend us on Facebook, will you? And next time on this program, what if bankruptcy was simply not an option? Consider the answer that many are struggling with in Spain. Tough luck.
Their bet didn't go well. Their houses lost value, and now they've lost money. And they want the rest of the economy to save them from the reckless debts that they took.
Marketplace Money is produced by John Buckley with Devin Robbins and Sonata Lee Narsis. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. I'm Bob Moon. You're invited back here next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM, American Public Media.